This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The war in Iraq and American politics. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Camped down the road from the Bush Ranch in Crawford, Texas, the mother of a dead soldier is raising the profile of the anti-war movement. That's political trouble, both for the president and his Democratic opponents. Despite an improved economy and new laws on energy and transportation, the Bush approval ratings are sinking fast because of the war in Iraq. But anti-war Democrats are attacking their party's leaders for not trying to capitalize on the president's problems. On To the Point, what are the benefits and what are the risks for Democrats who campaign against the war in upcoming elections? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Olney, back with To the Point. The economy's on the rebound and Congress is passing his legislative agenda, but President Bush's approval ratings have dropped to a new low. On To the Point, events in Iraq are eroding the president's credibility. Can the Democrats capitalize on the issue, or are they trying to avoid it? We'll hear that debate. We'll also learn what President Bush said today about the protesters that are camped out outside his ranch in Texas. First, this news update. For the first time in trading history, the price of crude oil went to $65 a barrel today. Tight supplies are pushing gasoline prices up too, but so far, demand keeps soaring. Philip Verleger is a senior fellow at the Institute for Economics in Washington. Always good to have you on our program.
Well, it's good to be with you, sir.
Sounds like a paradox. The prices are going up, but demand is going up too. Why?
Well, oil demand goes up when there's growth in the economy. Higher prices are will dampen the growth in demand, but economic growth really is about four times as powerful in boosting demand as prices are in snuffing it out. And right now, we just have no additional capacity to produce products. As a matter of fact, refineries keep going down. The entire energy system in the United States is old and creaky, some of it dating from World War II.
So, in other words, then, the price of oil, crude oil, is going up. We're having problems refining enough gasoline to serve demand. So prices are going up because of those forces. Why are people, though, still buying the gasoline?
Well, because it doesn't hurt very much. The price of oil has gone up, but most Americans, particularly Californians, feel much better off today because the value of their houses have gone up by so much. Americans feel much wealthier thanks to the growth in the value of their houses. A lot of Americans are seeing their incomes increase. Tragically, the poor, the average worker is not seeing this, but people feel better off, and so they're buying. They just continue to buy gasoline.
$65 a barrel sounds like an awful lot. How much higher do you think it's likely to go?
Well, the crude price is actually following products up, and it's kind of a technical thing called arbitrage. It's possible, given all the problems we're seeing with refining and everything else, we could see crude prices reach $100 sometime within the next year or two.
Within the next year or two. Now, would that be enough, do you think, to have the kind of ripple effect that would lower demand?
Not really. If you go back and you look at 73 and 79, when we had the last oil crises, in both those instances, the central banks raised interest rates substantially. They were fighting inflation. Today, we don't have to worry about inflation. The central banks just aren't worried thanks to globalization, so they keep pumping money into the economy. And until the Federal Reserve Board decides it really wants to raise interest rates and incidentally break the housing boom, the economy will keep growing and oil prices will remain very firm.
What about gasoline prices? Are they headed toward $3 a gallon?
I think they're headed up to and they're going to go racing through $3 a gallon.
How soon?
Probably next summer. We will get a respite this fall, as we always do when refiners can change the cocktail they sell at the gasoline stations. In the fall, they can put in much lower-priced blending components and ethanol, more ethanol, and so we won't see, the next real rush in prices after Labor Day will probably come in next February.
We're talking with Philip Verlager, who is a senior fellow at the Institute for Economics in Washington. This is To the Point from PRI. $3 a gallon by next summer. What about that? Will that affect demand?
Well, it's hard to say. A year ago, I would have said $2 would affect demand. Hmm. And a year ago, I said that $60 oil would lead to a recession. I was wrong. And I was not alone. I think probably if consumers see gasoline at $3 and $3.50 a gallon for any prolonged period of time, they may permanently start moving away from the SUVs and looking for more efficient vehicles. And in time, that will bring down the price of gasoline. Toyota is out there with the Prius, which is a very good car. And the longer gasoline prices stay up at these levels, the more harm that's done to GM and Ford and the purveyors of these very inefficient SUVs, and the more benefit that's done for the Japanese carmakers. So in time, we will see an adjustment, but it will take time.
Meantime, we've got, as you mentioned, problems with refining gasoline. We've also got fires and hurricanes, concerns about security in Saudi Arabia, all those things tending to push up the price. So I gather there are factors that need to be considered as well.
Well, yeah. The there is always the fear of Saudi Arabia. I don't believe, and there's no empirical evidence, that the fear of Saudi Arabia does much to the market, because oil is just too expensive. There are very few firms that will go acquire extra oil and inventories. But the hurricanes will disrupt it. Next spring, refiners are going to remove MTBE from gasoline. They're not using it in California anymore, but they have been using it in other parts of the country. That's going to reduce the supply of gasoline. That's going to add further upward pressure on prices. It's likely that we'll have more refinery problems because many of these refineries are 40 or 50 years old.
Okay. Well, no good news for anybody, would sound like to me, except the people who have stock in the gasoline or the oil-producing companies. Philip Verlager, as always, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Senior Fellow, Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C. A bit later in Niger, there's massive hunger, but it's not famine. We'll try to explain that cruel paradox on Reporter's Notebook in a moment. The war in Iraq and American politics on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Alney back with To the Point. Cindy Sheehan has become a media phenomenon worldwide. Camped out near the Bush Ranch in Crawford, Texas, she's made her voice hoarse from interviews with television, radio, and newspaper reporters. Her ear is reportedly sore from using her cell phone. She is demanding a personal interview with the president about why her son had to die in the war in Iraq and why the troops aren't being brought home immediately. Today, President Bush had this response at a news conference outside the ranch.
Listen, I sympathize with Mrs. Sheehan. She feels strongly about her position. She has every right in the world to say what she believes. This is America. She has a right to her position. And I've thought long and hard about her position. I've heard her position from others, which is get out of Iraq now. And it would be a mistake for the security of this country and the ability to lay the foundations for peace in the long run if we were to do so.
President went on to say that it would be a signal to those who are enemies of the United States, al-Qaeda and others, and make the country appear weak if the United States were to withdraw under what appears to be the difficult circumstances going on in Iraq. Well, Cindy Sheehan is not alone in her vigil outside the ranch in Crawford, Texas. There are, of course, the horde of media reporters and several other protesters as well. Dante Zappala is the brother of a Pennsylvania National Guardsman who was killed in Iraq. It was during the search for weapons of mass destruction. Dante Zappala, again, has been outside the ranch in Crawford. He's now found a motel nearby where he has a telephone. And Mr. Zappala, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Warren.
What's your response to what we just heard from the president?
Well, it's not really surprco-opting this sympathy for the families, and using that to inject just the same rhetoric that, you know, if we leave, it's a mistake. It'll be a victory for the terrorists, and it just shows the same ignorance for the facts that are coming off the ground there. You know, there's certainly a compelling emotional element to all this, but I really don't want that, you know, what's happening in Iraq gets lost in that. You know, the truth of what's happening there and the truth of really, you know, what's a real solution on how to get out of there is being lost, I think, when we have this window for the president to just say, I feel sorry for the families. Of course, they're making a difficult sacrifice. And, you know, he really doesn't know, and I just wish he would say that. It's like, my daughters are stateside and safe, and I feel really terrible about these families, but I don't know. You know, he doesn't know what it's like to sacrifice something. You know, he stayed stateside during the war, too, in Vietnam, so he doesn't know. And if he could just say that, I think he'd get a lot more credibility.
Tell us about your own sacrifice, the loss of your brother. What were the circumstances, and what was the president doing around that time?
Well, and this is the most difficult part on a personal level, Warren. My brother was, he was a caseworker for the mentally retarded in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, which is a small old coal mining town in northeastern Pennsylvania. Went up there to go to college, found a girl, had a kid, loved his son to death, was really just turned 30 years old, was really making, you know, a life for himself. And he joined the National Guard to serve his community, you know, serve his country and serve his community primarily, and to pay for his college loans. He got deployed in 2004. He was retrained. He was a forward observer in the National Guard. He had to be retrained on convoy security. And he was assigned with the Iraq Survey Group, as you remember, was actually looking for weapons of mass destruction after David Kaye had given up the search that January and come back and said, you know, they aren't here. I'm not going to find them. But be it politics or whatever, you know, my brother was still there in April, and this is also after the president had his press ball in March, a month prior in March. He made fun of it. He's looking under the lectern, you remember. He had the pictures of him in the Oval Office looking under the rug. And it's a big joke, and everybody's laughing, except my brother and his unit who are in Iraq looking for weapons of mass destruction in a very dangerous environment. On April 26th, they were inspecting a building. He was going inside. He was on his Humvee outside of the building. The other soldiers were going in. That building exploded. We still don't really know why that building exploded, but it's really, you know, Sherwood was hit in the back of the head by debris, and he was killed.
Well, we're very sorry to hear that, and obviously. And let me ask you this. As a part of the group now in Crawford, which is getting so much media attention, what do you say to those people on the other side who say it's really disloyal to criticize the president in time of war? It shames the memories of soldiers who have been lost, and it's bad for morale for those troops that are still in Iraq.
Well, as to the morale, I think the fact that, you know, our soldiers are being on now going on their third deployments, they're still there without proper armor. You know, my brother was on food rations when he died. I think those things have much more of an effect on morale, you know, that you don't see your family, you're torn apart, that you're, you know, suffering from PTSD and being forced to go back. I think those things have a lot more, you know, effect on morale than, you know, a few grieving families who are outside the president's ranch. The other, you know, aspects of that, you know, this is a democracy. You know, we live in a country where you know, every voice is valuable. And if you disagree with your president just because we're in a time of war, it's very valuable to do that. I mean, it was, you know, in the time of the Vietnam War, you know, we can look back at that, and there's just pretty much a consensus that was wrong, and that was based on an empty ideology.
Monica, there's a survey, a Latin American survey, I think. Did
you know,
how do we
break through that? Do we just, you know, do we just succumb to this apathy that says, oh, well, we just got to follow our president? You know, if your president's not doing the right thing, I think it was Thomas Jefferson, I forget, that said that, you know, the only title in America that's more important than president is citizen. And so I try to stay with that.
All right. Dante Cipolla, once again, the brother of a National Guardsman killed in Iraq during the time when the search for weapons of mass destruction was going on. We'll come back to him in a moment. Remind our listeners that the president himself said today that he and others like him, of course, have the right to speak, but the president said he disagrees. John Zogby is president and CEO of Zogby International, which is a polling firm. And John Zogby, always good to have you on our program. Mr. Zogby, can you hear me?
Hello.
Hi, John Zogby. Good to have you.
There you go.
The polls have been looking bad for the president of late. What do you think is the impact of what's going on now in Crawford, Texas, and the kinds of things that we've just heard from Dante Zappala and from the other, Ms. Sheehan included, Cindy Sheehan, who's there as well, and the kind of publicity they're getting?
Well, I mean, I think what it is basically is preaching to the choir. You know, this country was for the most part split upon the notion of going to war with Iraq, and then after we went to war for quite a while, they supported the troops on the ground and supported the president. But Americans want their wars to be quick. They want them over. They want them won. They want troops out of harm's way. And Warren, as early as the summer of 2003, you started to see support for the war plummet and has continued to plummet. But basically, I mean, I think we're at the bottom line right now. I don't suppose, barring anything cataclysmic, that opinion on this war is going to change. I don't think it's going to get lower. I don't think it's going to get substantially higher. I think it is where it is. I think some of the polling we did prior to going into war kind of indicated that this would happen once we were in a prolonged war and once there were numerous casualties in the war.
So you think then that positions have hardened and are firm on both sides, and even increased casualties of a large extent wouldn't change that?
Well, barring anything cataclysmic, yeah. I mean, you know, in the lead up to the war, in March of 2003, before the bombing actually started, we asked straight up, do you support or oppose the going to war in Iraq? And it was 48% who supported and 47% who opposed. Then we asked, what if there are hundreds of American casualties? Well, support went down to the low 40s. What if there are thousands of American casualties? Support went down to the high 30s. What if there are thousands of Iraqi civilian casualties? Believe it or not, that moved the needle the most. Support for the war went down into the mid-30s. And so in an important way, those projective questions, situational questions that we asked in March of 2003 have come into being, and this is where we are right now. And so, yeah, barring really the unforeseen, I think this is where we are, and I think this is where the president is in terms of public support for him and for the war.
John Zogby, president of and CEO of Zogby International. Let me go back to Dante Zappala once again, the brother of the National Guardsman killed during the search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. What do you think, or what do you hope will happen politically as a result of what you're doing in Crawford, Texas?
Well, you know, our hope is always just to share our story, and I think the difference between, you know, what Mr. Zogby is talking about is, you know, the only factor here is that we have real stories, you know, that now that the war has happened, you can't account for the Cindy Sheehans and my mother who's been doing this as well since my brother died, who go out there and just talk to people and share this story and personalize this story and how that can really affect people and make them, you know, vulnerable to the truth. And really see what's going on out there. Politically, you know, there's, you know, it is a very, I mean, I would agree that it's a very complicated situation in how we proceed. But it seems to me that if an overwhelming amount of people, if he's saying that it's over 60% of the people that want, you know, American troops out of Iraq, you know, that's a pretty overwhelming number, and if this is a democracy and that's what the American people want, you know, we're not ruled by a dictator here, so how do we move towards that?
Dante Zappala outside the ranch in Crawford. I want to go back to John Zogby, but before I do, let me introduce David Sirota, who was a writer and a political strategist on the Democratic side. His blog is davidsirota.com. He is one of those who was saying that the Democrats ought to stand up and be counted on this issue. And David Sirota, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What's your attitude toward the Democrats, what they're doing now, and what you think they ought to be doing?
Well, I think the Democrats in Congress are flailing around, or a lot of them are flailing around, not knowing how to address Iraq. We get statements of them saying, basically being critical of the Bush administration's strategy in Iraq, but unwilling to actually offer their own alternative strategy, much less support for any troop drawdown or an exit strategy. The problem with that is that it reinforces two things. One, it reinforces the fact that the Democrats specifically have nothing to say on national security issues. And two, it more broadly reinforces the fact that Democrats don't really know what they stand for and are always trying to have it both ways. And I think that the polls now show us that Americans think that the Iraq war has made us less safe. More Americans support forcing the Bush administration to come up with some sort of exit strategy. And the Democrats still are cowering in this position of feeling like if they don't, if they do come out and say that we should have an exit strategy on Iraq, that they'll look like they're weak on national security. Essentially, okay. What I'm saying is they're playing into the stereotypes that aren't really true.
Okay, this is To the Point from PRI. Back to John Zogby, President and CEO of Zogby International. Would this be a productive strategy, particularly given what happened recently in Ohio when a Democratic war veteran opposed to the war came very close to defeating a Republican candidate in a very, very Republican district near Cincinnati?
And I might add, a Democratic candidate with no history of political involvement at all, who came from nowhere to getting 48% of the vote. If we parse public opinion, we find that 61% now say that the war is not worth it, but that's 79-80% of Democrats who say that, and it's a solid majority of independents as well as the 24-25% of Republicans. And so, very simply, this is the strategy for the Democrats. Ironically, John Kerry, who gained national fame back in 1971, I believe it is, by saying, "How do you tell a man that he's the last man to die for a mistake?" is somebody who refused to admit that he made a mistake in supporting the war in the first place. And I'm only talking now as someone who would give strategic advice to the Democrats. The Democratic constituency is way, way, way out ahead in opposition to this war than most Democratic candidates or office holders are.
So you think, then, that the Democrats are making a mistake at the moment by not emphasizing the war more?
Oh, I think so, to be sure. Right now, the Democrats really have no message to the American people on pretty much anything. I mean, just say no on Social Security and just say no on the energy plan and just say no, just say no. That's probably good enough to get 48% of the vote in nationwide elections, but as we've seen in 2000, 2002, and 2004, that's not enough to win. Where do you get the remainder? You go after that base, which also includes Democratic-leaning independents who happen to be very, very much opposed to the war. This would be the clarity that would energize Democrats who might waver about even voting.
John Zogby, President and CEO of Zogby International. We are going to take a very brief break, then we'll come back and we'll continue this conversation about the Democrats and the war in Iraq. We again have heard from the President today and his comments on Cindy Sheehan and others who are outside the ranch in Texas. On Reporter's Notebook, how can there be such terrible hunger in Niger, but it's not called a famine? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the war in Iraq, the problems that the president is having with it at a time when the economy is good, when he's getting his agenda pushed through the Congress, and yet his approval ratings appear to be falling very quickly because of the war in Iraq. We just heard John Zogby, the president and CEO of Zogby International, the polling firm, say that opposition to the war has now fallen so much amongst Democrats, amongst independents, and even, he said, 25% amongst Republicans, that this is the strategy for Democrats to separate themselves from Republicans and try to gain back control of the Congress. This is what he said. John Zogby would add clarity to the Democratic message. David Sirota is a writer and political strategist once again, and his blog is davidsirota.com. David, in the aftermath of that recent election in Ohio, where Paul Hackett came so very close to winning as a Democrat in a Republican district with an anti-war message. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee got out a memo, and you've been critical of that memo. Why?
Well, they issued a memo to all House members, or all Democratic House members, saying, you know, here are the lessons to learn from the Hackett race. And the memo had no mention, absolutely no mention, of the Iraq War. It basically made the case that that the Democrats got close in that race because the message that Republicans are corrupt resonated. Now, I have no doubt that that message was a part of it, but Hackett, most of his campaign, or much of his campaign, the high-profile issue was his willingness to speak openly in opposition to the war. And to then go out and tell Democrats, for the party to tell Democrats, essentially that it didn't have anything to do with the war by virtue of omission, basically says to me that the party is just not willing yet, as a party, to speak credibly or honestly about Iraq.
Again, David Sirota is a blogger as well as a writer and political strategist, davidsirota.com. Bill Burton is spokesperson for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. And Bill Burton, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What do you say about the memo that came out after the Hackett near upset victory, I should say? And why wasn't there any mention of the war in Iraq?
Well, first of all, I want to say this was a tremendous victory for Democrats to come so close in a district where George Bush won by 30 points, and we very nearly were able to squeak one past the goalie and win one in very Republican territory. As for Iraq as an issue, you know, I certainly appreciate the opinion of David and other folks out there who have said that, you know, Iraq was a very important part of this race. But in fact, on the ground, it was much different than what you got from the national news. There were front-page stories in the Washington Post and New York Times about Paul Hackett, Iraq war veteran, speaks out against Iraq, the whole son of a comment that he made about the president. But the fact of the matter is, if you talk to folks on the ground, if you read the newspapers, if you went to campaign events by Paul Hackett, what he was talking about was education and the economy. And it was a much more local race. It was about ethics and about Gene Schmidt versus Paul Hackett. Was Iraq a part of that? Sure. But it certainly was not the be-all, end-all in this race.
So you're saying then that the coverage, and there was plenty of it because of the possibility of an extraordinary upset that was sort of sensed by the national media before the election actually took place. You're saying then that the war as an issue was exaggerated by that reporting?
I'm saying that there were two different sets of coverage. And one of the coverage, one set was local. And locally, the race was about education, the economy, ethics, Gene Schmidt and her problems in her past.
Gene Schmidt was a Republican candidate, excuse me, for an open seat created because the president appointed the incumbent to a executive position. Go ahead.
That's right. And nationally, it got a lot of attention because Paul Hackett was an Iraq war veteran and, you know, had a very great story to tell and did a great job of doing it, ran a strong campaign. And for all those reasons, folks nationally started to catch on and say, hey, there may be something here. But what they focused on was him being an Iraq war veteran, which, very important, obviously, but on the ground, was not the single largest cause of his great momentum and near victory in that race.
Well, what are you advising candidates around the country to say about the war, particularly in light of what we heard earlier from John Zogby? I'm not sure you were listening at the time. I summarized a bit of what he said earlier, which was that he thinks this is the strategy for Democrats to try to win in upcoming elections and that it'll provide clarity, which he says the party so far has failed to do. Bill Burton, you still with us? We seem to have lost Bill Burton, spokesperson for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. We will try to get him back in the meantime. Let me go back to David Sirota. On the ground, very different story from what we heard in the national media. Is that sufficient explanation for you as to what the memo said, advising candidates that, again, as we just heard from Bill Burton, it was local issues primarily made the difference?
Well, with all due respect to the DCCC, I think that is...
DCCC is the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee.
Go ahead. I mean, I think that is, to put it mildly, is nice spin. I mean, the fact is, Bill admitted that the Iraq War had played a big role. I mean, he said it was part of a lattice of things, which all campaigns are. The point that I made is that the memo didn't even say that the Iraq War was any part about it. It said it basically said it had nothing to do with it. Now, this cuts to the fact, I mean, in part, that the leaders of the Democratic Party, in fact, the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee himself, was a loud, outspoken proponent of going to war. And my point is this. It doesn't matter if you were a proponent of going to war at this point. The fact is the Democrats are afraid to take a position on the war because they had taken a pro-war position. The point is you can come out and say, we made a mistake. Just as John said, we made a mistake, we were lied to, this is it's time for a policy change in Iraq. And I'm sorry, the Democrats just don't have yet the courage to do that as a party.
We have got the line back again with Bill Burton, the spokesperson for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and I want to thank you for coming back on. Very much appreciate your being available. What about this?
I'm really sorry for the technical difficulties.
I understand that. What about this and the contention by David Sirota, and he's not alone in saying this, that the Democrats voted for the war. Why don't they just say they made a mistake and oppose it?
I think the important thing here is to look at this race in Ohio. Look at the ways that we were able to make gains. Build on that as a springboard into 2006. As for the war in Iraq, which is an important issue in every single race in this country and important to every candidate who's going to be running for Congress or folks who are in Congress right now, you know, everybody has to decide what's the right way for them to talk about the war in Iraq to the voters back home in their district. You know, whether or not it's to, you know, use inflammatory language as suggested, or whether it's to, you know, talk about what our plan is there, what our how we're going to make sure the troops have the supplies they need, how we're going to make sure that we're waging the best possible fight that we can for our troops and our soldiers and our interests. So, you know, as for one set of talking points for every single member of this caucus, you know, the bottom line is the Democratic Party is a big one, and we welcome folks from, you know, all different walks of life, and you know, the diversity of this party is what makes it strong. And so to try to make our party one where, you know, everybody is singing off the exact same talking point doesn't really speak to who we are as a party.
Well, you're saying then, as I understand it, that the war in Iraq, support or opposition to the war in Iraq, is not going to be a definitive way of distinguishing Democrats from Republicans as far as the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee is concerned. You can have candidates who are supportive of the war. You can have candidates who aren't. Is that right?
I think the one thing that folks can't agree on is that the president and this Republican Congress have done a poor job of getting our troops the supplies they need, have done a poor job of letting folks know what plan there is, if there is one, for, you know, the fight for democracy in that country or, you know, any part of the war in Iraq. I think that that is widely agreed upon by Democrats in Congress, Democratic candidates, and the public at large. So I wouldn't make too much of an overarching statement about what candidates are going to say or aren't going to say about the war, but I would say that There is a lot of room for agreement.
Okay. Bill Burton, I want to thank you very much for being with us and for coming back after we had a problem with the phones.
You betcha.
Spokesperson for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Listening to all of this, I don't know if he's rubbing his hands or not, is Andrew McCarthy, who's a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a contributor to National Review, very much a supporter of the war, and I believe a Republican as well. Andrew McCarthy, good to have you with us.
Hi, Warren. How are you?
Good. What, from a Republican standpoint, would be the consequences for the Democratic Party if, in fact, it came out, as David Sirota and others have suggested that it do, and say, look, we're against this war?
Well, you know, I think that the position that was reflected by Mr. Burton is probably indicative of the reality that, you know, the Democrats are not, they, in the long term, see what the consequences of a strategy of opposing the war in a very powerful way could be disastrous for them. The one thing that hasn't come out.
Wait a minute. Why would they be disastrous?
Well, let me try to say one thing that hasn't come out in the minutes that I've been listening to your discussion is the fact that, you know, we are fighting the enemy over there, and if mistakes have been made here, I think the mistakes have been A, that we haven't, in a powerful enough way, conveyed the sense to the American people that Iraq is about the war on terror, that this is where Islamic militancy is right now trying to take us on. And if we were to withdraw in the face of gains by the enemy that that we engaged after 9/11, that would be a disastrous consequence. It would be terrible for the country. It would put us. It would be terrible for national security to withdraw under circumstances that looked like we were surrendering to the enemy that we started out fighting on 9/11. Also, if we get hit again, which as hard as people are trying to prevent that from happening, could happen at any point in time, what the public is going to want to know is why we weren't more aggressive in Iraq. What they'll want to know is why we allowed the national security mission of degrading the ability to project power of Islamic militancy was subordinated to other missions like, spreading democracy and rebuilding Iraq, things which are important but which are not as important as the main national security mission. So I think that if we were to get hit again, people would want to have answers about why people in government didn't push harder to take care of the very serious threat that we face.
Okay, very much in a more elaborate form, what the president said today, once again repeating his often heard statement that we're fighting them over there so we don't have to fight them over here. Let me go back to David Sirota, our liberal anti-war Democrat at davidsirota.com. What do you say to that? The Democrats for a long time now have had reputation, certainly fostered by Republicans, that they are weak on national security. I believe you mentioned that earlier yourself, or one of our guests did in any case. Wouldn't the Republicans simply, in the way that Andrew McCarthy just described it, be able to use that against the Democrats very effectively, especially if there was another hit?
Well, I hope the Republicans use that argument because it arrogantly assumes that the American public is stupid. And if you read the polls, the American public isn't stupid. The American public overwhelmingly realizes that the Iraq war made the United States more unsafe. There were not Islamic militants running the country in Iraq before we went in there. The attempting to extend the war on terror rationale to Iraq assumes that the American people are stupid. They are not. The American people realize that the war is what has made us unsafe. The American people will be asking questions if we're hit again. Why haven't we found Osama bin Laden? Why have we taken our eye off the ball in Afghanistan? Why in 2002 did President Bush remove special forces from Afghanistan and move them into preparations for a war in Iraq that had nothing to do with al-Qaeda? Those are the questions that will be asked. Those are the questions that Republicans don't want asked, and those are the questions Democrats should be asking right now.
Again, back to Andrew McCarthy, our Republican voice. USA Today, CNN Gallup poll, it does say 57% think Iraq has made the United States more vulnerable to terrorism.
Yeah, well, I, the only thing that Mr. Sirota said that I agree with is that the American people are pretty smart, which is why George Bush is still president today in the last poll that was taken that actually made any difference. You know, look, you need, when you are at war, which is the most important national security issue, indeed the most important issue, to continue on a daily basis to explain to people what it's about, to make sure that people understand what the connection is between what we're doing in Iraq, which was a profound supporter of terrorism for years, and connect up those efforts to what is the war on terror that we began after 9/11. You can't, and I think if the president's to be faulted here, it's because you can't run on a national security platform and then basically not talk about it so much for 4 or 5 months afterwards. I think that, you know, to the extent that a mistake has been made here, it's that we haven't made the case enough, not that there's not a case to be made.
Andrew McCarthy, again, at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, contributor to National Review magazine. Let me go back to our first guest, Dante Sipala, the brother of the Pennsylvania National Guardsman who was killed during the search for weapons of mass destruction, who was one of those outside the ranch in Crawford, Texas. Just interested in your comment after hearing all of this political discussion that's transpired since the last time we heard from you.
Well, it's really disappointing on a few levels. I think first to respond to what the fellow from the Democratic Party was saying, they want to weigh in on this as a political issue, and they're putting their finger up to the political wind to try to see which way it's blowing, and they just show this incredible fear to take a stand on this, because for them to take a stand on this, they will have to say it's a mistake, and what they're going to have to say is, and this is really hard to say, is that our troops being in Iraq are not part of the solution. They're part of the problem. They're inflaming Islamic terrorism. They're not solving the problem of Islamic terrorism. It's a proving ground. We're making the terrorists better. We're giving them some practice. You know, we're a recruiting tool. And to say that, you know, then it's real easy to say, oh, well, you're unpatriotic. You don't support the troops. And they're afraid of that. But I think if they say that, that would resonate. As far as what the other guy was saying, that's just ignorant. I don't know any way to put it, you know, not to be insulting, but it just shows blatant ignorance. You know, to continue these insinuations that Saddam Hussein was somehow a threat to our country. When you look back at what happened on 9/11, and we were attacked by 15 Saudi Arabians, and you look at the terrorists who are in Iraq, which, you know, the foreign terrorists make up less than 5% of the insurgency right now, according to the U.S. military. Those folks are coming from Saudi Arabia. Where are they getting their money, Saudi Arabia? So who's our enemy here? You know, and I always wonder, what are we doing? You know, what are we not looking at now? I mean, Saddam Hussein was our friend in the 80s because he supported, you know, we played one off the other. Osama bin Laden was our friend because he was fighting, you know, the Russians. So what are we not looking at now, you know, that we're ignoring for the sake of this quagmire in Iraq, which has just gotten worse and worse. You know, things have steadily gotten worse. It's not
okay.
Something that's, you know, it's going to take leadership. And it's not going to take rhetoric, and it's just really disappointing to hear rhetoric, you know, as a solution to this problem.
All right. Once again, Dante Sipala, again, the brother of the National Guardsman killed in Iraq. Our sympathies to you on that, and thank you very much for joining us from outside the ranch in Crawford, Texas. Thanks to Andrew McCarthy at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, organization set up to be supportive of the war, also a contributor to National Review. Thanks to our earlier guest, Bill Burton of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, David Sirota of davidsirota.com, the liberal democratic blogger, John Zogby, president CEO of Zogby International. Lots more to talk about in the future, and you will hear it here. This is To the Point from PRI. Recently, the international media have broadcast and published heartbreaking photographs from the West African Republic of Niger, shrunken babies and emaciated children whose malnourished parents can't get them enough to eat. But food shortages are being cruelly compounded by economic and social change in Niger, as we'll hear in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Worman Alney back with Purporter's Notebook on To the Point. Niger has suffered a poor harvest this year, but that's nothing new. One thing making the problem worse than it's been in the past, though, is that the link of brotherhood and solidarity has been broken. That's according to a radio journalist quoted in today's Washington Post. The author of the story is Craig Timberg, who joins us from Maradi, a town at the epicenter of Niger's hunger crisis. Understand, Craig, there is a bit of a delay on the phone, so let me just put the first question to you. What is the link of brotherhood and solidarity that your source was talking about, and what does it have to do with the hunger crisis?
Well, you know, a lot of things have changed very quickly in Africa, as I guess everybody knows. And what the radio journalist is talking about, and what an imam at a local mosque who I spoke to also is talking about, is that the sort of traditional way, the sort of the African way of reaching out to your village and your family seems to not be happening in this hunger crisis as they, you know, as they recalled it happening in the past. I mean, Niger is a place, you know, they have some experience with this sort of stuff. About once a decade, something like this happens. There's a lot of hungry people. And what the folks here have told me was that, you know, in the past, you know, it was a little bit more of an all-for-one thing. But in the past decade or so, is, you know, as Niger has moved into a more modern and sort of liberalized economic model pushed by the IMF and the World Bank, that some of that spirit of communal spirit seems to have deteriorated a little bit. People seem more focused on making money, perhaps, than they used to. The imam mentioned that that even devout Muslims seem to be less likely to set aside some of their income to feed hungry people than they used to. So it seems clearly a lot of other things are happening, but that seems to be a little bit a piece of the picture.
Well, then another piece of the picture seems to be, as you also report, that there is not such a shortage of food that you could call this a famine, that food is, in fact, available to some people, but they just can't afford to buy it.
Yeah, famine is a dicey word because what it means is sort of everybody's hungry in a reasonably uniform way, and also that lots of people are dying. Now, people are dying, your children in particular are dying, and fairly high numbers, but, you know, I arrived to this crisis, as my editors keep reminding me, a bit late. By the time I got here to MARD, BBC had been here for a couple of weeks, CNN had been here for a couple of weeks, and we had all been seeing these truly horrendous and heartbreaking pictures on television. And I walked into a place that seemed to have an awful lot of food. You walk through the market, you just saw piles, sacks of rice piled up, sacks of millet piled up. Kids walking around selling peanuts and sugar, and in the hotels, the food was abundant and quite good. And so I just have been attempting to sort this out in my own mind. And of course, I went out and very quickly found really, truly, horribly hungry people and kids that looked, you know, frankly, looked like they were two steps away from death. And in attempting to square these very disparate images, I've been trying to drill in a bit. I'm not sure I'm entirely satisfied with the answers I've gotten so far, but there is food here. There is a market here. I guess if there's one overarching problem, is that the people who need the food don't have it. They don't have the money to buy it.
Again, Craig Timberg is Johannesburg bureau chief for the Washington Post. He's reporting today from Maradi in Niger. The president of Niger has denied the reports that the country is facing a famine. I suppose if you parse the word as you just did, then you could justify that statement. But he says people look well fed. I guess that's also partly true. But does his statement reflect the fact that the government's not doing much about getting that food that's there already to the people who can't afford it?
Yeah, I find that one really tough to explain, to be honest. I mean, look, he's right. Most, you know, the UN World Food Program, the various aid groups here will tell you this is not a famine for the reasons I just mentioned. But the notion that, you know, the people are generally well fed is frankly hard to swallow. When you walk around, even in the markets, you'll see people who can't afford food and look quite terrible. And so, you know, I think it may be culturally very difficult to accept that you know, maybe they can't feed their own people. And I think there's also a little bit of defensiveness over this issue because they're, you know, they're being blamed for it by folks. And, you know, here the world doesn't care at all about Niger for years and years and years and years. Then suddenly, you know, 100 journalists and 1,000 aid workers swoop in here and all they want to talk about are dying babies. And so, you know, I think that what is happening in part is just people are getting their backs up and they're saying, you know, the problem is not just that there's hungry people here right now. The problem is that we're the second poorest country in the world, and you know, 9 years, 11 months out of every decade, nobody really seems to care about that. So I think that's where that comes from.
Listeners to this interview who are concerned about this and people who have seen the extraordinary pictures that you mentioned for some days now are going to want to know, you know, what can I do to contribute in any way to alleviating this situation? That's not your job. You're not there as a relief worker. You're a reporter. But what can you say in response to that question?
Well, I'll quickly tell you who's kind of on the ground here. You know, the UN World Food Program is here, Oxfam is here, CARE is here, UNICEF is here. Doctors Without Borders at this point has the best and most sweeping of the programs and has for quite some months. They're very much here. So people should take their pick and contribute if the spirit moves them. I would say as a kind of a more general point, if I can preach for a second.
Please do.
You know, probably the more important thing in the long run is for the rest of the world to maybe get to know Africa a little bit. I've spent the last year and a few months of my life here, and my family has too. And it's an amazing, wondrous, fabulous, and frankly quite frustrating place. And it's probably the least understood place in the world. And, you know, Africa would be a lot better off, and the world would be a lot better off if we knew each other a little bit better, if people got on airplanes and flew over here, not just to help, but just to know people here and understand their lives and understand their challenges and understand their wonderful qualities as well. And I think that that's, to sort of go back a step, that is some of the anger you hear out of officials here is just this sense of disconnection. The world doesn't care. The world doesn't care. They don't know who we are. And then suddenly they're in here pointing fingers at us. So, you know, help out, but, you know, find a trip.
Well, Craig Dimberg, thank you for your reporting from there and for those words as well. I'm sure our listeners will take them into consideration. We appreciate them, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Again, Johannesburg Bureau Chief for The Washington Post, reporting from Maradi in Niger. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Jonah King and Andrea Brody, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.